to introduce the second tonight's speakers, who's Amanda.
Thanks.
My name's Amanda and I'm an addict.
Amanda.
Thank you, Jerry, for your chair. It was lovely to listen to you, and I identified lots, and I'm just thinking two thermal vests wasn't a very good idea. I'm so hot, I'm just like, oh! And it is really very scary, this meeting. I don't know why, out of all the London meetings, but I do find it the most intimidating meeting to share at. And I know the first time I got asked to share here, I just had that sort of wobbly voice syndrome and didn't really have the confidence to share what I wanted to share. And I was thinking about the last time that I shared here, which was 2.5 years ago. And when I was here, I was really, really sad. My little sister had just passed away. And I don't really remember. It was about 3 days after her death, and I don't even remember what I shared. But I'm in a very different place now. I'm not in a sad place. I'm in a very happy place. I'm a very, very grateful recovering addict, and I love Narcotics Anonymous, and I love what we do here. And it's an absolute privilege to be asked to speak at this meeting. And I feel like I've done quite a few chairs recently because I've had a birthday. So I feel like there's a lot of people in the room that have recently heard me. So I need to, like, change my story completely, which obviously I can't do. So I'm going to start at the beginning. I used drugs for a long time. I wasn't brought up in London. I was brought up on the South Coast. And I feel like with my parents, it was like being brought up in the wilderness. I wasn't shown anything like a normal person, you know. And what I was shown by my parents was how to party. That was it, really. They were both drinkers. They loved drinking. They loved being out of it on alcohol. And so that was, I think, from an early age, I was just very used to being in that environment. And when I was young, the things that I loved doing most was reading, I guess because it was escapism, so I could just get into books and just lose myself, you know, and I'd spent hours reading. And the other thing was sport. I was a lunatic around sport. And I think the other thing around that was it would keep me out of the house. It would mean I wouldn't have to go home because I'd do after-school clubs. And really, when I look back, you know, sport was my first buzz. You know, I loved running. I didn't like slow. I liked 100 metres, you know, addict, come on. You know, and I'm still like that today. I went to a combat class 2 weeks ago in the gym, right? And I hadn't been to a class for about 5 weeks, so I was really out of condition. And there was this Spanish lady taking the class, and she was quite hot, and there was very loud rave music. And I think I'm Jessica Ennis or something. You know, I turn into this, like, come on! And I couldn't lift my arms up for 2 weeks. I was sort of just like this, you know, broken. And I just think that is the nature of who I am. It doesn't matter how long I've been clean, I am an addict. You know, in whatever I do, I take that energy with me, especially in the gym. Gym is, I've given myself hernias. I was in hospital last year because I'd been kettleballing with a large 12 key weight, showing off with a kettleball, and couldn't walk for 4 days and was hospitalised for 2 days. I phoned my partner, I said, I'm in hospital. She said, what? I said, I did a kettleball class at lunchtime, you know, and it's like, that is what I'm like. I just have this sort of, this drive in me that is still very ferocious after years clean. You know, and if you that drive that I've got, when it translates into drug addiction, it was even more ferocious. And a lot of people that know me, it's quite funny, when I use drugs, people were scared of me because I was I'm Larry. You know, I'm not someone that's a quiet wallflower type, as lots of you know. And if you put me in a dance floor, I remember once being in a car park in Surrey, and this bloke said to me, we're off to Club UK because we hear there's a girl up there that rips guys' shirts off like that. And I was like, oh my god. And that was me. I used to take loads of drugs, and then people would come in and I'd just rip their shirts off when I was, you know, just demented. And then my friend reminded me the other day that when I was driving once, this bloke in front, he was a very old man, and he was driving very slowly, and we were in the car behind, you know, me driving right up his arse with my bumper touching his bumper, and he stopped at a traffic light when it was orange, and she reminded me that I got out of the car, went up, he had his window down, and I put my hand through it and I squeezed his nose really hard and went and got back in my car. And I mean, like, normal people don't do that sort of thing, do they? It's normal people don't have that, the audacity to do that, number one. You know, and that was the nature of who I am is quite like that anyway. I have this sort of quite wild, quite rebellious, quite outside the box. I don't like to conform. And you know, and I think that was, for me, that was why I got into drugs. Drugs were this sort of wild, yes, come on, let's be these crazy people. And so I got into that identity. You know, 13, 14, it was like acid, mushrooms, going to school, doing half a trip at lunchtime, going back to school, coming up on the trip, you know. And I loved it. I loved it. I thought everybody should take LSD. I thought it should be put in the water supply for the masses, you know. Especially the police station. We used to come up with all these cunning plans that we should get into the drink supply at the police station and make all the police trip, you know. And I really thought, you know, I thought it was enlightening. I thought my spirit, you know, I thought this is very hallucinogenic drugs is where it's at. And until I started having bad trips, and then it was like, oh no, this is a horrible drug. I mustn't take this, and continue to take it for another 3 years. Until it was, you know, just horrible. Every time I take it and come up, I just think, what have I done? I've taken that drug again. I hate this drug. And I remember going to I think it was 1985, a Stonehenge festival, and they'd all been beaten up at Stonehenge. And we went to Westbury and we took this acid, and it was liquid acid, and my friends took it before I did. And they just started stuttering. They couldn't even talk. And they'd taken two of these sort of freshly dipped trips, and I thought, I'll just take one, I'll be careful. And it was like going through a nuclear holocaust, you know? And I couldn't stand up for about 2 days. My friend fell in the fire. She burnt all her ear. My other friend tried to eat the chillum. She thought it was an ice cream cone. And we went back to school, 14 years old, on the Monday. She had a stutter for about 5 months. You know, and it was like, yeah, you know, we love drugs. This is what we do. And I was like 14. You know, 14. I'd lied to my mum, said I was staying there. She'd lied to her mum. And off we went in the little van. And, you know, and that was my thing. I loved festivals. I was a bit of a hippie. And I loved that thing of going sort of into the country or going out into, like, nature and taking loads of drugs and getting out of my box. And I loved it. And I looked at anyone that didn't do that and just thought, you're weird, you're boring, you're straight, I really don't want to be you, you should have my life. And I left home really young so that I could have that lifestyle more freely. It's very infringing being around your parents that tell you you can't do this. And my mum wasn't really like that. I could sort of do what I wanted. I could smoke joints in the house and I could get drunk, but, you know, she wasn't that keen on the other drugs. So it was just that thing that I felt I had to leave home early. And I remember my first bedsit in the town that I was brought up in, and people used to climb up. It was on a first floor, and people used to climb up in the night to get in and wake me up. And, you know, and it was just, I loved it. I thought, this is great. I'm so glad I left home. Looking back, I remember my mum saying to me, she said, you've done everything. You haven't got anything left to do apart from get married. And I said, oh, I don't think I'll ever do that. That's, you know, that's straight people do that. I'm not going to do that. And my drug use just accelerated. You know, I started using, but I always had that thing where I looked at heroin and I saw there were sort of junkies that lived in my town, and I looked at them and I just said, I'm never going to end up like that. You know, I love party drugs. I'm never going to use a bit of gear. And there was that, I was in that real sort of hierarchy, you know, that looked down on people that used heroin. And I thought, why do you want to take a drug that just sends you to sleep? What's the point of that? And And my friends used to do over chemists, so I used to get picked up from school and they'd have the DDA box in the back, and then we'd go and read the book and find out what the drugs did. And at an early age, I didn't even know. Half the time, it'd be just, oh, I'll have a pink one, or I'll have a yellow one, or a green and white, and and there were all these sort of pharmaceutical speeds that we used to take, like Dexedrine and green and clears and brown and clears and all these, and I loved it. I thought it was just, and I revelled in coming up with little pharmaceutical mixes of different drugs and I sort of believed I was my own little sort of pharmacy at the age of sort of 16, 17. And I was always coming up with, one to come up and then one to come down. And this just went on for a number of years. And I really thought, I didn't think my life would change. I didn't see a need for it changing. But what happened for me was the town I lived in was very, very small, and I got very well known for selling drugs, and I couldn't go down the town centre without getting searched, and I eventually got raided, and they nicked me for some drugs, and I didn't go to prison. I was very lucky I didn't go to prison. And so I had to leave that town. And that pattern for me is something that repeated itself time and time again, where I moved through different parts of southern England and then had to leave because of trouble with the police. And what happened as well in terms of earning lots of money, the more money I earned, the more money I used, the more drugs I used. So the deeper my problem got. And by the time I was sort of 19, 20, I was taking the drugs that I said I never would. And I started to feel like the wheels were starting to come off a little bit. I'd always use a substance every day, but I still was at that point where I was enjoying my drug use. I was going to a lot of parties. I went out with a guy who had a huge sound system, so, and we used to put on these free parties and go off and get on the phone and go with my trailer, and then we'd stop in a field and we'd plug the sound system in and get the generators out, and then we'd have a couple of thousand people, and it was great, and I loved it, and I felt like I was in this centre of this big scene that was sort of evolving and very pioneering, and we'd all take loads of ketamine and stand on top of haystacks and go, I feel like a sugar puff, and just, demented, really, really demented, but it was great. There was that whole thing that, again, I just thought, this is it, it was 1989, 1990, very good ecstasy. That drug for me was the one that, I felt like I'd really come home, And it was the one for me where I loved that feeling of unity that you got on that drug, that feeling of just being like, you love everybody. And so I did that for a number of years until the police changed the laws and impounded our sound system, and then that all sort of shut down. And by that stage, I was absolutely frazzled. I'd been using the Class A drugs a lot more, and I'd started to spend a lot of my money. I'd saved money for a number of years. My money addiction had always run very, very closely to my drug addiction, so money had always been my security. And I started to realise at 24, 25 that actually my drug addiction was, eating into my sort of pot of money. And things shifted for me as the party scene changed, 94, 95. Things slowed down a lot, and my drug use again shifted. And it became a lot darker, a lot more seedy. And I moved up to London then, and it was like the enjoyment and fun had gone. My first 10 years of using drugs were fantastic. I'm not going to sit here and go, I took drugs and it was awful, because I wouldn't have done it for so long. I took drugs for nearly 20 years, and my first 10 years were great, but the last 10 years were me trying to stop, really. And I realised with the drugs that I used that, I, especially crack cocaine, for me, crack cocaine did things to me that, in terms of what happened to me mentally, I mean, I was a psychotic crack user. I would have such bad psychosis. You wouldn't want to have a pipe with me, because I would be like, the feds are everywhere, and I'd be like, shh, shh, don't say anything. Or if we'd be in a property, I'd be barricading the door, just really not enjoyable to use with. And when I look back at that level of psychosis, and I did that for most probably the last 6-7 years of my use, it was around crack, and I was demented. I was absolutely crazy mad person. You know, I would sit in a flat in Brixton and put my hands on the wall and go, the spirits are coming, you know, and really think that there were things living in the wall. I'd spend a lot of time under this sideboard thinking the police were coming in. People would be like, what's Mandy doing down there? And it would just be like, oh, that's where she is, you know, and that's where I felt most comfortable. And years just holding my drugs in my hand, thinking they're coming to get me. And when I look back on that, I think, you know, the power of that drug, of how insane I was. I used to inject it as well, and I would quite often fit when I was injecting it, and I do actually believe something looked after me at that time. Mm. I would quite often inject just the white and fit so badly that I would feel like the top of my head had exploded off, and I used to believe that something used to come and rest on my head and stop the fits. And in a way, I think maybe that was my friend and I believed that we had these angels that would come in. And looking back on that, I think, you know, something looked after me. You know, I pushed it to a level where I, you know, put a lot of drugs in my body over, especially the last few years. And I'd lost everything, you know, all the stuff that I'd gained from putting on parties and the money and the flats and the houses and the nice cars and the nice clothes, that was all gone. I was homeless, I was living on the street, I stayed on people's floors, I lived in crack dens, I lived in bin sheds, I lived in hallways of, flats. So if there was a flat I could get into, I'd go and use, you know, and I've had guys come out and kick me, you know, wake me up by kicking me, and then I've had other people come out with an old woman come out with a little breakfast tray and serve me a cup of tea in the morning, you know. So, and I remember being homeless and feeling how hopeless that was, to feel like I'm not part of this society, I don't fit in, you know. I was a prostitute, so in the day I'd shoplift and at night I'd sell myself, and you know, and I felt like there wasn't really a place for me, you know, and I didn't know, number one, I didn't know how I got there. It was like, how, you know, I went from sort of having this great time to this, how did I get here? And I used to look in the mirror and just think, oh my God, what's happened? And I had that thing where I would pick my arms, pick my face, so I would just be constantly covered in these sort of crustaceous, sort of scabby, crack sort of sores, you know. And so it wasn't a pretty sight. I was very, very skinny, and I didn't, you know, I didn't want to stop. If someone had come up to me and said, oh, I know where you could get off drugs, I would just be like, you know, I love drugs, this is what I do, you know. And it got to a position for me where I had lots of court cases building up, and I knew I was terrified of prison. That was the one thing. I got nicked a lot. I used to get nicked just to have somewhere to sleep, actually. So getting nicked was quite a nice thing to happen, because they'd give you a bit of breakfast, you get a Valium, and, you know, you get your head down. You know, you're sort of all right for a few hours. But prison for me held this sort of fear, because I'd never been, and so I had all these court cases coming up, and I thought, you know, I've got to do something. And my drug worker said, let's try and get you into detox. And then by the time it came to court, I was actually in a treatment centre. So I went to court. I represented myself in court, because I didn't get it together to get a brief. So, and I stood up and I said, I'm 3 months clean and I'm in treatment. And I had this whole list of offences, and the judge said, keep doing what you're doing and I'll give you a suspended sentence. If you leave that treatment centre, you go to prison. And that was my first experience of doing the right thing and something good happening. You know, I'd had a history in my life of bad things happening to me, and I never really connected that to my drug use. But looking back, all the bad stuff that happened was connected to my using. And what I made was a crucial decision in that treatment centre that I was going to give this a go, you know. And I've got to say, I was talking to someone in the break about how difficult it was to get from that white keyring to 30 days. You know, for most of us that can remember, those first 30 days for me were absolute hell. You know, I didn't sleep. I wanted to use 24/7. My head was on me. You know, I'd never stopped using everything, you know, and I'd always judge people that had done that. I thought, God, why would you want to come to NA? That they're a cult, they're a God-fearing, you know, they're like a God squad. You don't want to go and get clean with them. Mm. And I think that was my addiction that had all of that stuff, you know, because my addiction didn't want me to get well. And I work in the drug field, and a lot of people, when they say, oh, no, I don't want to do 12-step, you know, and I immediately think that's because, you know, we get well here, you know. I go to, I quite often go back to my detox where we have a Christmas reunion. And when I go to that Christmas reunion, when I walk in the room, all the people that look well in that room come to NA. You know, you've got all these other people that still dabble a little bit, that look rough, you know, really rough. They're still at it. They're a bit, you know, they've got the scabs and they're very skinny and they've got the green pallor that goes with using. And then there's all us NA lot with, you know, bright eyes, bushy-tailed, you know, looking happy, you know, light in our eyes. And that reminds me every year of why I stay in this fellowship, you know. And so, yeah, I love what we do here. And I love what's happened to me in this process. You know, I came in one of the most unconfident, skinny, sort of such low self-esteem. You know, I never imagined that that I would get anywhere in recovery. You know, I didn't think I'd ever get a job. I remember saying when I first got clean, oh, I want to be a social worker. And they said, oh, you can't do that because of certain things on your criminal record, you know. And I felt like my criminal record was this thing that was just, you know, I was never going to get anywhere. And what I've realised over the years, my criminal record is the biggest asset I've got. You know, I've got the most colourful criminal record. When managers want to see it, I sort of have to do a little speech with them to prepare them, you know, because they don't know my part. And I sort of go, right, so just be prepared. There's going to be lots of things on there you're going to be, you know, and it's fine. And I can, the one thing that I really feel is that I am feel incredibly proud to be Mandy from the street in Brixton, to be now Amanda, 13 years clean, loving life. You know, and I have no shame to say that was my life and that's where I came from. You know, NA has given me so much healing around the stuff that I never thought would be healed. And, you know, when I first got clean, I just thought, number one, I didn't think, you know, my body would repair itself from the track marks. And I had this great counsellor in treatment, and I remember her pulling up her arms, going, you think yours are bad? And she had these, like, massive holes, you know, and she was 15, 20 years clean. And that just, you know, because I would always be, like, covering my arms. And she said, you know, if someone loves you, they're going to love you for your scars. And next day I was on the tube, dirty great big black lines up my arm like that. I was like, yes, you know. But it's just, like, so inspiring that people in this fellowship can say something to you and it can give you that moment of freedom. And that thing that we hear, you know, the truth sets us free. I heard that a lot when I first got clean. And it really, you know, it has done for me. I've come in and when I first got clean, I'd share anything in meetings, really inappropriate stuff, you know, and quite often really shocking. You know, I had that thing, I'd just go, yeah, I was a junkie prostitute in a bin shed, you know, I'd do punters for a fiver, and, you know, and just things like that, because I'd go to these really posh women's meetings in West London where they were all like, oh, right, well, we've got the Volvo and the three kids are outside, you know, and I'd just think, right, so I'm going to scare this lot, you know. And what I found in that women's meeting was after about 6 months of going, once I got round the accents, they were lovely. They were lovely. And the Volvos and the fact they had everything that I didn't have. That was the reality, you know. They had cars, they had nice shoes, they had, you know, designer clothes. But they were lovely. And they got me, I became secretary of their meeting. I was 9 months clean. And I felt so privileged. And one of those women to this day is still my sponsor. She's been my sponsor for a long time. And, you know, my sponsor's not one of these really, like, spiritual people that's sort of, you know, floating and says, pray to God. My mum, look, see, that's how it is. She's like my proper mummy. That's what my sponsor is like. You know, I don't phone my mum for advice on anything. You know, she, in fact, my mum is the last person I would ever, if the shit's hitting the fan, I would never phone my mum, because she will make it about her in about 5 seconds flat. Oh, what am I going to do? It's like, but I will phone my sponsor with anything, and my sponsor's incredibly practical, and she knows me really well. She knows my patterns, she'll nail me, she'll say, Amanda, you're doing this again, you need to do this, this and this. And I've just done a step 8 with her, step 8 and 9 this week, actually. And I, you know, I was going to share something in this room this evening, but I actually can't, because the person that I've got to do the amends to is in this room, so I can't really go into details. But anyway, it's just that thing that you sort of think 13 years clean, quite well, been in the fellowship for a long time, but my behaviour at times still really shocks me. You know, I might have done lots of work on myself, I might have done lots of step work, I might have been really honest with my sponsor, but I still have moments when my back is against the wall where I will go into my default position of lying, stealing, being dishonest. You know, that is inherently part of who I am, you know. And I've got, this last step 8 hasn't been around really, really big harms. It's little things that I do with people. And it's about my relationships and how authentic and how honest I am with people. And my the work that I've focused on in the last few years has been around relationships. What I realised when I got to about 3-4 years clean was that I had this stuff go on with partners. I could get into relationships very, very easily, but getting out of them for me was exceptionally difficult. What comes up for me when I leave a relationship or someone finishes with me is I have feelings like I want to die. You know, like I want to jump in front of a train, like I want to drive my car into a wall. You know, I cannot cope with those intensity of feelings. And what's happened for me over a period of years, the cleaner I got, those feelings intensified. Each time I went into a relationship and came out, this stuff got bigger. And by the time I hit 5 years clean, the pain was absolutely incredible. And then I went and did the interferon treatment at 5 years, which just sort of smashed everything wide open again. I felt like I went back to being, you know, a newcomer again. And what happened was that after, when I hit 6, 7, 8 years clean, I felt incredibly broken. I felt, you know, there was this stuff around relationships. There was the stuff, I had really chronic anxiety. I do public speaking. That's what I do within my role at work. I do a lot of public speaking. So I don't get scared about that, but I get anxious about silly things, conversations with people. And what happened was the interferon had given me chronic anxiety. So I went on to this, had 4 or 5 years where I lived in hell in recovery. And I just thought, you know, this isn't how I'm supposed to live. And at 9 years clean, I felt like I was having a breakdown. And I'd been very resistant around medication. I was like, I'm in NA, I'm never going to take meds. You know, we soldier on, this is what we do. And something happened and I ended up at the doctor. And the doctor said, why don't you try some medication for your anxiety? And I had that whole thing of coming here and saying that as well. And it felt all a bit, oh, you can't say that. You know, we don't do that here. And actually, you know, looking back, my resistance after 3 months of being on this SSRI, my life became normal. You know, for the first time in about 5 years, I had a bit of serenity. You know, I could sleep at night. I didn't feel like I had people's conversations in my head all the time. I didn't wake up in the night having panic attacks. And I started to be present, emotionally present. Because I'd been anxious for a number of years, I hadn't been present. And I started to realise and see stuff around my friends, about myself and about my life, and realise there was a whole lot of work that needed to be done. And it was around relationships and how I am in relationships. you know, for me, I've always had a lot of faith that my higher power will look after me. And I've been shown that in stuff that's happened in my recovery, stuff that happened in my addiction, that the fact that I lived through it. And I really needed to get back to God being in charge of my recovery. What had happened for me over the years with the anxiety and my sort of belief in myself was that I'd taken the reins back and I turned into a complete control freak. And someone said to me once, you know, the reason that we're often very controlling as addicts is because we've come from such chaos, you know. And as a child, I lived in chaos. So control for me is a way of sort of, you know, putting key rings in a line, makes me feel nice inside, you know, and it, a bit OCD as well, but it's a thing of sort of control. And what I realised was my whole life was controlled, you know, my relationships were controlled, I controlled everyone in my life, or if I didn't control them, I took care of them. And so I went and did a whole load of steps around my relationships. And what I realised was that I'd been on the run from me. I spent 9 years in recovery looking after you lot and not looking after me. And inside me was still this huge gaping hole, which is what I hit every time I came out of a relationship. And the core of it is abandonment, you know. And that, and even when I started talking about my sister when she was dying, when my sister was dying, I was incredibly sad. But if I compare the pain of how I feel when I come out of a relationship compared to the death of my sister, the actual pain of coming out of relationships is bigger than that. And that sounds, and some of you might think, oh, that's really not right, but that's because that stuff is my core stuff, you know. And I, you know, losing my sister was horrifically sad, but it doesn't compare to the my core gear. And my sponsor always said to me, you know, between 5 and 10 years you hit the stuff that you would have used on in the first place. And for me, that was around my codependency, around how I am. You know, if I go out with you, I put everything into you. I don't know how to save anything back for me. And within that, I'd never had a relationship with me. I was terrified of me. I didn't do anything on my own. I always did things with people, you know. So at 9 years clean, I started doing that work and developing a relationship with myself. Thanks. And what happened was I had this incredible shift after writing the 12 steps around relationships rather than around drugs, was I started to develop some self-love. I didn't have that critical voice in my head anymore going, you're a piece of shit, you can't do that, you're not enough. You know, all of those really awful messages that had been playing in my head for a number of years in recovery. And that voice got really quiet, and instead I started having this loving voice saying, you can do this, go on, have a go. You're good enough, you can, you know, so things really, and because that relationship, that internal stuff changed, all the relationships in my life changed, you know, especially the relationship with my partner. You know, I used to give a list. I'd get up in the morning and go, right, I'm doing this, you're doing that. You know, she'd look at me and go, you know, and bless her. I mean, bless her for staying with me. I don't believe, actually, if I'd done that work on relationships, I would still have a partner. You know, I think the reason that I'm in a 6-year loving, healthy, supportive relationship is because of the work I did, you know. Because what I have is that thing that everyone's always going to leave me, because that's what I had as a child. So, and I will force that with people. I will, my behaviour will push people to the limit where they will walk away, you know. And with my relationship with my partner, I did a lot of pushing away, a lot of like testing how, you know, oh, do you really love me? And she stayed through all of that, you know. And I always think there should be a key ring for being in a relationship and having no back doors as well, because that was one of my patterns, early recovery. I'd be in a relationship, but I'd always have a plan B and C, backup, you know, male, female, wouldn't really care on that front. And the minute that relationship finished, I'd be off on the phone, you know, straight into the next one, because I couldn't deal with that stuff inside, you know. And for the last 6 years, I've had no plan Bs, and I feel very proud of that, that I've stayed, my head has stayed in the relationship, not just physically. I haven't slept with anyone, but, you know, mentally, I haven't had obsessions, I haven't wanted to act out with other people. You know, and I really, that stuff for me, that healing that I've got around people, you know, I have a lot of really, one of my best friends is my first love. We got together when I was 15, I left home for him, and he's in recovery, and the relationship I have with him, he's like my brother, you know, he came to my sister's funeral, I've been to his mother's funeral, and we can phone each other up and talk to each other about anything. You know, I don't have any qualms about holding anything back. And that's the one thing that I've learned in recovery is to be so transparent about your gear with the right people. You know, that's what's got me through over the years. My behaviour has not always been as suggested. I think Jerry said he'd done everything. Did you say you'd done everything? No, you hadn't. Yeah, that was it. I haven't either. I've done a lot of things. I've slept with friends, had threesomes. I had a partner who had a sex club. I loved that for a while. I thought, oh, this is great. You know, it was this... You know, because it was wild. It was pushing the boundaries, you know. And my addict is still very much like, I want to do anything I can. Even though I'm clean, I want to still push boundaries. And I have to be really careful with that stuff. You know, it's caused me a lot of damage in the past. And I know my behaviour has the ability to take me out the door. So it's that thing that I've done everything... that was not suggested, but I stayed clean through it. You know, it's not what I recommend. But I love being clean, and I wouldn't give up what I've got in this fellowship for anything. You know, my recovery is still the most important thing in my life. The other thing that I do a lot of that is my passion is H&I, and Jerry talked about that. You know, we've got someone in the room today who left prison 24 days ago, and she's still clean today. So I'd like to give her a little round of applause. Yeah. Only I say that because I think the stuff that, if you want a commitment that is going to rock your world, get into a hospital, an institution, or a prison. Because that, for me, is where it's at. That is, I come out of Holloway Prison buzzing, yeah? Forget a crack pipe. That is where I get my rocks off, you know? And those girls, when I go in there and I take meetings and I take inspiring chairs in, I see what we do. I see the miracle of what we give to other people. And I'm at present, I'm the coordinator for Holloway. This is my little plug before I end here. And we're trying to start another meeting. We've got two meetings a week, one in the detox and one on the main wing. But our meetings are so well attended now that they've asked us to do another meeting. So if there are any women in this room tonight that have over 18 months clean and would love to come and do a commitment in Holloway Prison, please come and see me afterwards. I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for watching.